Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Dorothy Gundy, John Russell, and Anna Mateo. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Dorothy Gundy.
Go to any college or university in the United States, and you will find most students carrying the same items: books, laptops, cell phones, and their official school identification cards, or IDs. These small plastic cards do more than show the names and pictures of the students who own them. They also permit students to open the electronic locks to campus buildings and borrow books from school libraries. In recent years, some colleges and universities have added an additional use for ID cards: buying things. The schools enter into agreements with banks so students can link their cards to private financial accounts. This way, students can use their cards to pay for things like food on campus and school supplies. In other words, their IDs become debit cards. However, new research suggests that the way these card programs operate can harm students. Caitlin Vitaes is the Higher Education Campaign Director for the U.S. Public Interest Research Group, or PIRG. Her organization aims to use research to support and protect people's financial interests. She told VOA that PIRG has been looking into agreements between schools and banks for several years. This April, the group released its latest findings. PIRG found that overall, students with campus debit cards paid over $24 million in fees during the last contract year. For example, students may be charged fees if they use another bank to withdraw money, or they might be charged fees if they spend more money than they have in their bank accounts. Many international students face fees for using the cards to buy things from their home countries. Any large fee can create unexpected problems for students, says PIRG's Caitlin Vitaes. And she argues that banks do not make possible fees clear enough to students.
But Vitaes's biggest concern is whether some schools may urge students towards banks that may harm them financially. She notes that some banks pay colleges and universities for permission to advertise their debit card programs on campus. The advertising can appear to be part of official school programming, she says, and students may feel pushed towards opening accounts.
PIRG also found a connection between schools with paid agreements and student fees. Students at schools that received money from banks ended up paying up to 2.3 times more than students at schools with unpaid agreements. One example is Wells Fargo Bank. In recent years, the company has been involved in several situations that were either illegal or very harmful for consumers. It also earned nearly $11.3 million in fee payments from students at the 24 schools it had paid agreements with last contract year. Vitaes notes that many schools need financial support anywhere they can get it. But, she says, when schools are setting their students up for lifelong relationships with Wells Fargo, does that set students up for success? I would say no. VOA contacted several of the schools in the latest PIRG study.
Texas State University, where students paid over $1 million in fees last contract year, chose not to comment. So did Florida International University, where students paid over $1.3 million, and Virginia Commonwealth University, where students paid over $500,000. The University of Nevada, Reno, or UNR, started its paid agreement for a campus debit card program with Wells Fargo in 2005. Last contract year, UNR students paid over $700,000 in fees. The bank paid the school about $100,000. Penny Lethley is the campus card manager for UNR. She argues that the fact that over 9,000 students have campus debit cards shows that the program works well. "To me, that's a good program," said Lethley. "That shows that many parents and their students want to be involved in it." She notes all banks have fees. And, she says, students can choose whether they want to use the Wells Fargo Campus Debit Card program. If students are paying extra, Lethley suggests, they are likely using their cards for things beyond the free services the accounts offer.
But Tanya Ladha argues irresponsible use is not the only explanation for why students face fees. She is the director of the Center for Financial Services Innovation, a nonprofit consumer support group. Ladha claims that some students just do not have the information they need. To be sure, banks can give special permission to parents to observe students' debit card activities, and Wells Fargo Bank offers lessons on financial responsibility. In addition, workers at its on-campus bank speak several languages. But Ladha notes that some parents lack financial knowledge themselves, and few high schools require students to take financial education classes. As a result, a number of students know little or depend on what the banks tell them. In April, Wells Fargo announced changes to its campus debit cards. The company said it would permit account holders to overdraft their accounts without a fee once a month. They can also withdraw money from another bank up to four times a month. "We're proud of the fact that four out of five students that join us through the campus card program stay with us after they leave school." I'm Dorothy Gundy.
And I'm John Russell.
Now, the VOA Learning English Program, Words and Their Stories. On today's program, we talk about the word field. But which one? There are many different kinds of fields. First, we will talk about fields in which you can work. A common question when you first meet someone in the States is, What field do you work in? Or simply, what is your field? Work fields are usually general. For example, if you are a doctor, you would answer that you work in the medical field. A lawyer is in the legal field. And a marketing specialist's field is business. If you are a farmer, you might work in another kind of field, an area of open land planted with crops. Some farmers work in the fields from sunup to sundown. However, some outdoor fields are not used for farming. They can also be large open areas outside, great for hanging out and relaxing. Now, another kind of field is also outside, but we use this one for sports activities. And this type of field has led to several common expressions. Fair play is an issue in most sports. No one wants to watch or play a game in which one team has an unfair advantage over another. Everyone wants a level playing field. But not just in sports. We use this expression anytime fairness is important. A level playing field is when the conditions of competition are fair or even. Everyone has the same shot at winning. This expression comes from the fact that for a sports field to be fair, it must be the same for both teams. It would be unfair if one team had to play on a rocky, uneven part of a field, while the other team played on smooth ground. In level playing field, the word level is an adjective, but we can also use it as a verb. So, if you level the playing field, you have done a good thing. You have given everyone equal conditions for success. Now, let's go back to sports, in particular, baseball. When playing baseball, the infielders and outfielders are the ones who field the balls. They catch the balls hit or thrown in the field and then make the best play they can. So we can say they are playing in the field. However, they are not playing the field. That is something completely different. Playing the field has nothing to do with sports. We use it mostly to talk about dating. Someone who plays the field is romantically involved with more than one person. The expression comes from horse racing. The horses in a race are the field. And in that field of horses, there are the favorites, those considered most likely to win. And there are long shots, those less likely to win. Long shots are riskier to bet on, but they pay more money if they win. So gamblers often bet on other horses other than the favorite. They would play the field or several horses in one race. Sometimes we might use playing the field in other situations where we want to keep our choices open, but that usage is not very common. Maybe you have heard of this expression before, or maybe it came out of left field. To come out of left field is another baseball term. It means something is a surprise to you. You were not expecting it at all. Word experts dispute its exact origin. One possibility comes from how a baseball player scores. a runner on third base, in position to score at home plate, has his back to left field. As he runs home to score, he cannot see the ball thrown to home base by the left fielder. And then, surprise, he's out at home plate. I hope you have enjoyed today's show on field expressions. Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The stock market crash of 1929 began a long and difficult period for the United States. President Herbert Hoover struggled to find solutions as the nation sank into the worst economic crisis in its history. But the Great Depression was not the only problem demanding answers from Hoover. The president also had to deal with a number of foreign policy issues. I'm Mario Ritter with Chris Cruz. We look at how the Great Depression affected relations between the United States and other countries.
My mother told me she passed away. Said, son, when I'm gone, don't forget to pray, 'cause there'll be hard times. Hard times. Oh, yeah, yeah. Who knows better than I?
There were revolutions in South America. Japan launched a campaign of aggression in northeastern China, and the economic situation in America created serious problems in relations with Europe. Hoover succeeded in some areas of his foreign policy, but he failed to solve America's economic troubles. And, like most Americans, he failed to recognize the importance of political changes taking place in Japan and Germany.
Herbert Hoover's foreign policy was marked by his desire to make friends and avoid war. Like most Americans, the new president had been shocked by World War I. Hoover had seen the results of that terrible war with his own eyes. He led the international effort to feed the many European victims of the fighting. The new president was also a Quaker, a member of the Religious Society of Friends. Quakers oppose war. Hoover shared the wish of most Americans that the world would never again fight a major war. To him, the bloody bodies at Verdun, the Marne, and the other battlefields of World War I showed the need to seek peace through negotiations.
Hoover worked toward this goal even before he entered the White House. Following his election, he had several months before becoming president. Hoover used this time to travel to Latin America for 10 weeks. He wanted to show Latin American nations that they could trust the United States to honor their rights as independent nations. Hoover kept his word. The year after he took office, his administration announced that it would recognize the governments of all Latin American countries, including governments that the United States did not like. Hoover told the American people that he would not follow the Latin American policies of President Theodore Roosevelt. Teddy Roosevelt decided in 1904 that the United States had a right to intervene in Latin America if it disagreed with the actions of governments there. Hoover said this was wrong. He told the country that it was more important to use friendship than to use force.
Hoover withdrew American forces from Nicaragua. He also arranged to withdraw them from Haiti. And he showed restraint as some 50 revolutions shook the nations of Latin America. Some revolutionary governments opposed the United States. They refused to pay debts to American companies, or they claimed ownership of foreign property. But Hoover refused to advance American interests by force. He wanted to prove that the United States could treat Latin American nations as equals. That policy was quite successful. Relations between the United States and Latin American countries generally improved under Herbert Hoover's leadership.
The situation in Europe was much more difficult and much more serious for the United States. The problem was simple: money. The Great Depression did not stop at America's borders. It moved to Britain, Europe, and beyond. And it brought extremely hard economic conditions. In Germany, the value of the national currency collapsed. Inflation forced people to buy goods with hundreds, thousands, even millions of German marks. They lost faith in the system, and they looked for some new leader to provide solutions. The economic crisis also put great pressure on the international circle of debt that had been created after the war. Suddenly, American bankers could no longer make loans to Germany. This meant that Germany could not pay back war debts to France and the other Allied nations in the War to End All Wars. And without this money, the Allied nations could not repay money that they owed American banks. The circle of debt fell apart.
Why should I be standing in line, just waiting for bread? Once I built a railroad, I made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?
The situation grew worse and worse throughout the early months of 1930. Hoover finally had to announce that all nations could delay their debt payments to the United States for 1 year. Hoover's actions did what he wanted it to. It put a temporary stop to the international debt crisis. But it caused great damage to private banks. People lost faith in the banking system. Throughout Europe, people withdrew their money from banks. As a result, the European banks could not repay more than $1 billion that they had borrowed from private American banks.
This was not the only problem. Nations throughout Europe were also forced to take their currencies off the gold standard. This meant their money no longer could be exchanged for gold. The economic situation grew worse, and as it did, serious political tensions began to threaten peace in Asia and Europe.
The threat in Asia became clear first. Japan had defeated Russia in a war in 1905. This victory gave Japan control over the economy of the southern part of what was then called Manchuria in northeastern China. As years passed, Japan began to feel threatened by two forces. First, Chinese leader Chiang Kai-shek was trying to organize all of China under the control of his nationalist forces. Second, Russia was extending the Chinese Eastern Railway to the Russian port city of Vladivostok. Japan's army took control of the government in Tokyo in late 1931. The army was fearful of the growing threat to Japan's control of Manchuria, so it moved Japanese troops immediately into several Manchurian cities, and it claimed political control of the whole area. President Hoover and most Americans strongly opposed Japan's aggression, but they were not willing to take any action that might lead to another world war.
Japan's military leaders knew that the people of Europe and America had no desire to fight to protect China. And so the Japanese army marched on. It invaded the huge city of Shanghai, killing thousands of civilians. Western leaders condemned the action. American Secretary of State Henry Stimson said the United States would not recognize Japanese control in these areas of China. But again, Hoover refused to consider any economic actions against the Japanese, and he strongly opposed taking any military action. The League of Nations also refused to recognize Japan's takeover. It called Japan the aggressor in Manchuria. Japan reacted simply. It withdrew from the League of Nations.
Most Americans were not happy about Japan's aggression, but they were not willing to fight force with force. This was less true, however, for Secretary of State Stimson. Stimson was a follower of the old ideas of President Theodore Roosevelt. He believed a nation could only have a strong foreign policy by being strong and using its military power in times of crisis. But Stimson's voice was in the minority. Most Americans did not believe Japan really threatened the security of the United States, and they were not ready to risk their lives to help people in China. Opinions changed only after Japanese planes attacked the American naval base at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, in December of 1941.
The same story was true in Europe, but France was worried about the rising power of the Nazis in Germany and the fascists in Italy and Spain. France proposed the creation of an international army. Hoover opposed that idea. He called for all nations to reduce their weapons. He believed that negotiation, not force, was the way to solve the problem. But the new leaders in Germany and Japan would listen much more closely to the footsteps of marching troops than to the high words of peace.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.